From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This week, we saw the first small signs of a plateau in the number of COVID-19 hospitalizations in New York. That does not mean the spread of the disease has stopped or that we can end physical distancing. It does mean that smart, collaborative action can have an impact, and that healthcare and medical professionals continue their race to treat and understand this disease. So in a moment, we're going to talk with the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, the world's oldest continuously published medical journal, about the kind of questions and knowledge he sees coursing through the medical community now and what it means in the fight to control the COVID-19 global pandemic. We're going to start with an editorial that recently appeared in the journal titled 10 Weeks to Crush the Curve. Dr. Harvey Feinberg writes, quote, "If we act immediately, we can make the anniversary of D-Day on June 6th, 2020, the day America declares victory over the coronavirus." And Dr. Feinberg joins us now from San Francisco. Dr. Feinberg, welcome. You wrote that editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine on April 1st. Do you still think it's possible to declare victory over the novel coronavirus by June 6th?
Maybe now it's more realistic to look at Independence Day, July 4th. That would be pretty momentous. The truth is, though, I don't think we're yet on a path to get either date the day of victory.
And why is that?
It starts with the fact that at this point, we have not really adopted a military warlike strategy in what the president has correctly described as a war. In fact, it's a two-front war on the economic side and on the virus side. We do not have a unified command structure, which is the basic element of strategy in fighting any war. That unity of command has to start at the top and go all the way through every aspect of the parallel activities you need to do to win a war like this against a disease as hard to beat as coronavirus.
Well, in fact, we have seen in other countries how that sort of unified command ethos has been quite effective, right? I was most recently reading about New Zealand. Now, granted, it's a much smaller island nation, but they are on their way to crushing their curve, small as it was to begin with. So we know that it works. What right now do you think? You put a six-point plan, actually, forward in this editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine. Of those 6 points, what do you think is the most realistic for us to achieve first of all, even in the time we have remaining?
The most critical next point is get widespread testing available. If we do not have the core intelligence about where the virus is, who is affected by the virus, who may already be recovered and partially or fully immune to illness, we cannot make the most intelligent decisions. The irony is, the earlier you start in the course of a pandemic, the more success you're likely to have. But in order to generate the will to start early, you have to be able to show a governor, a mayor, a county supervisor, this is what's happening in your town right now. And that's the intelligence that we most sorely need to mobilize effectively against coronavirus.
Now, we've been hearing this call for much more testing, much more information, as you're talking about, for weeks, if not months. In reality, while the testing is ramping up, it doesn't seem like it's still anywhere near where it needs to be.
This, again, gets back to the unified command structure. If there were an individual designated, clearly identified as the person who is going to drive testing to where we need it and what the steps are, what the strategies are, who's involved, who's participating, where do things actually stand, what needs yet to be accomplished, that would have put us in a much stronger position at the minimum to know where we stand. And frankly, right now, we're still depending on a kind of combination of private sector companies coming forward, university labs stepping up in a brilliant and important way, but we don't have a unified approach to solving this aspect of the problem, or frankly, any of the aspects.
Well, so to be clear, what you're calling for is more than what say, even Vice President Mike Pence or Dr. Anthony Fauci, the positions they're serving in right now. I mean, I think what you're calling for is, as you say, a person who actually not only has the trust of the president, but perhaps even the authority in terms of leading the anti-COVID-19 response?
President Lincoln needed Ulysses Grant to win the Civil War. He didn't come to Grant immediately. In fact, it took some time. But Grant was the person in whom he entrusted to carry out and execute the war against the enemy. I believe President Trump needs his Ulysses Grant. He needs the person he's going to trust to carry out on a day-to-day basis and execute. The president has to manage overall strategy, and the president has to balance the economic front against the viral front. I believe we could make more concerted progress under the leadership of a designated individual with the authority to act, to move, to get things done. No excuses, no delays, no backbiting. Get the job done.
Could the same or a close second be that this kind of concerted effort state to state? I mean, you're there in California. California, in some senses, has been a little bit ahead of this by going into a statewide lockdown earlier. Could we have an aggregation of efforts amount to the same thing?
We certainly could, and I believe it would be an advantage. Each state could manage its own program in a similar way. Each county could manage its program. Each municipality, each town. The idea is that bringing people under a unified command structure means that you avoid miscommunication, you avoid delay, you avoid lack of accountability by making clear the levels of responsibility to execute. Right now, we have some parts of our country that are in the midst of a conflagration. If it was the analog of a war, they're in a firefight. New York City has to do everything it can every minute of every day to save lives. Other places are at much earlier stages in the course of the pandemic, and they can take more concerted action to avoid the fate of those places that are now dealing with the epidemic full blown. But we need to have organization, we need the intelligence, we need to be able to execute on a plan.
Right. So you also write about supplying health workers with that personal protective equipment, differentiating the population into different groups, and then figuring out in terms of immunity or exposure, how to treat or perhaps people could go back to work, inspiring and mobilizing the public, and learning through real-time fundamental research. Now, there's another thing that you've written just recently in the New York Times about smart isolation and quarantine, which is not necessarily something we have yet put into practice here in the United States. What is that?
The idea of the points you made of dividing everybody into their relationship to this epidemic. You either are a patient and you've been documented. You may have symptoms not yet documented by a test, but very probable in the current context that you are infected. You have individuals who've been exposed but are not yet expressing any symptoms. You have individuals who are recovered from the disease, and they may indeed have immunity. You need to take each group and identify what it is to do for each. Patients have to be isolated, not necessarily in a hospital, depending on how ill they are, but away from where others get exposure. Those who are exposed to a known patient should be put into a quarantine. That simply means a separation from interaction with other people who may be vulnerable. And you do that for enough time, in this case about 2 weeks, so you can be pretty confident that that person exposed is not going to come down with the illness, and that person is no longer a threat to their family, to their loved ones, to their neighbors. Smart quarantine means applying a graded separation so that you can take the steps necessary to protect people from others who may have the infection. We need to have more capacity for separate facilities to house quarantine patients. Everybody who lives in a congregate arrangement, like a nursing home or a dormitory, they need to have a place to go that is safe, well-managed, and has medical attention in case they do begin to develop any symptoms. So the smart quarantine idea is to put in place these facilities that could serve as the repository, the location where any of us who want to protect our families, who want to be good citizens and not endanger others, we can comfortably and with proper medical supervision stay for a period until we can be confident that we did not contract the infection.
So that's the key difference. It's not just quarantining at home, but in a if you've been exposed in a completely different location, a hotel, convention center that's staffed the way you just described it. Well, Dr. Harvey Fineberg is president of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. He's also former president of the National Academy of Medicine. We have a link to his editorial that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine. That link is at onpointradio.org. Dr. Fineberg, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you very much.
Well, when we come back, we'll be speaking with Dr. Eric Rubin. He's the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. And by the way, for a link to the New England Journal of Medicine's coverage of COVID-19, go to our website, onpointradio.org. And coming up on Monday, it's been nearly two decades since Madeleine Albright left her post as U.S. Secretary of State. We'll be talking with her about her new memoir, about her career after she left office. So what questions do you have for Secretary Albright? I'm particularly interested in hearing your questions about the role you think diplomacy should be playing right now in managing this global pandemic. So leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. There's more of the show when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. What did public health officials learn this week that might change how we respond to COVID-19 over the next month? Here's Dr. Deborah Birx, White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator, talking about how new models this week are projecting fewer COVID-19 deaths than earlier estimates.
What has been so remarkable, I think, to those of us who have been in the science fields for so long is how important behavioral change is. And how amazing Americans are in adapting to and following through on these behavioral changes. And that's what's changing the rate of new cases, and that's what will change the mortality going forward, because now we're into the time period of full mitigation that should be reflected within the coming weeks of decreasing mortality.
Well, Dr. Eric Rubin joins us now. He's editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Rubin, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
So first of all, let me ask you, what is the closest analogy in infectious diseases you can come up with that helps us understand what we're experiencing right now with this COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, it's interesting. When I used to be an associate editor at the Journal and the Ebola outbreak came along, the then editor-in-chief said to me, "This is the outbreak of your lifetime. All infectious disease people should be over there treating Ebola patients." And I thought, wow, this is the infectious disease outbreak of my lifetime. Unfortunately, he's been proven wrong.
It seems like proven wrong in a lot of different ways, right? I mean, the global nature of this, how fast it's spread. I mean, walk me through this. What are the major differences?
Well, Ebola is a terrible, devastating disease, and that spreads incredibly easily. and has a very high mortality rate. I don't mean to compare them to the two as diseases, but it's a relatively easy disease to control, and an airborne illness like this one is much more frightening because it can be transmitted so readily that it's hard to isolate people and prevent transmission.
Mm. So, Dr. Rubin, obviously the pathogens themselves and the diseases they cause are quite different, bad, but different. What about how the political and the social response and how that's had an impact on the medical response, as we've seen the pandemic sort of wash across the world?
Well, let me give you a very infectious disease and very U.S.-centric answer to that. When Ebola came, there were obviously huge political and economic implications in the areas where it occurred. Here in the U.S., infectious disease people in hospitals were making all sorts of preparations for Ebola possibly coming to the U.S. Fortunately, it only happened that there were a few cases. We were overprepared for that. This is a very different situation. We were clearly underprepared for the size of the epidemic that occurred.
Underprepared. That seems to be a constant refrain here. But we just talked to Dr. Harvey Fineberg, as you heard, in the previous segment. And he still believes that there is an opportunity here to act in a more concerted way. Those crush the curve ideas, as they were called in the New England Journal of Medicine. Are there other aspects to this notion of crushing the curve that we should be thinking about right now?
I think that there are a couple of parts to that question, Meghna. First is our lack of preparation. And certainly we were underprepared, and certainly we should have known that this was coming. But that's kind of past. In some future time, we should really look back and try to figure out what sorts of mistakes were made, and yes, maybe place blame on those who caused this. But right now we've got what we've got. And I think what's so appealing about what Dr. Fineberg, Harvey, has been saying is that we do have tools that are quite useful today. What Harvey didn't talk about is the tools we might have coming up in the next month or couple months that might help crush the curve.
So let's talk about them. What are those tools?
Well, I think there are a lot that might come. For one thing, we're going to have a better idea if vaccination will work, because vaccination would be the ultimate tool. We certainly aren't going to have vaccines, but we're going to start to get animal studies and such that tell us whether the vaccine candidates that are in trials now look like they have a good chance of working. Now, don't get me wrong, it's still going to take a very long time for a vaccine, even if it looks effective, to get out there, because the big issue with vaccines is whether or not they're safe. And the only way to test that is by testing progressively larger numbers of people over time. But that would be obviously the game changer in all of this.
We're watching the development of vaccines in real time, and we know we'll be able to see the results of the testing. So as we get closer through those phases of trials, would we adjust sort of our containment strategies along the way?
Perhaps. We certainly would change our strategies toward making of vaccines if it looked like some of the approaches we were taking were less effective than others. And I think we want to know that now, because we're placing very large bets on the approaches that are being taken now.
Okay. What should we do in the next month, for example, knowing what we know today about the progression of the pandemic, where the hotspots are, et cetera? What would you advise us to do in the next month?
I think that we should go back to what Harvey said, because his big message is that the tools we have today are quite powerful and we're not implementing them fully. There are many things that we could do right now. Those involve leadership, of course, and I know you talked at length about how that leadership should be implemented. But there are logistical issues that we should be approaching. How are we going to separate people from each other? How are we going to segregate infected people from uninfected people? How are you going to care for those people who are infected but not that ill, who would otherwise fill up our hospitals? That's going to take a lot of work. It means creating facilities. It means creating jobs for people to take care of other people and also take care of those people who are left behind, the uninfected, susceptible people who are left at home. I think there's quite a lot to do, but these things could make a big impact. I'd add that we still could do a better job of caring for the sickest patients, as we're seeing right now in New York, which is being overwhelmed, something that is likely to occur in more and more cities. We can do a little better with more advanced planning. Should we be creating new facilities in addition to the hospitals that exist? How are we going to staff them? How are we going to use our ventilators appropriately? I think thinking through these issues in advance really helps clarify the thinking when the emergency really strikes.
Right. So, I mean, in normal times, quote unquote normal times, these are questions that it might take quite a while to find the right answers for. I mean, you're talking about systemic issues, right? How do we staff these facilities? Where should we locate them, et cetera? Can we come to those same answers very quickly now in the next month and actually get these kinds of facilities up and running?
I'm afraid I keep echoing Harvey, yeah. But I think that his statement that this is war is correct. In wartime, we do extraordinary things and we change some of the norms that we've established. I think we're seeing a lot of that right now. I don't think that people are so resistant to the idea that dramatic times call for dramatic measures. That means we need some will, and my sense is the will is there, and we need some leadership, and that is a little more variable right now.
Mm. So, Dr. Rubin, it seems as if we actually might kind of be on a dual track for the next month. There are the mitigation strategies, which we've talked about and that Dr. Feinberg talked about, that we could and should adopt even more aggressively. But then also there's more information that we're going to be getting about treatments and how effective they are and possibly new treatments. More information from testing as that hopefully continues to ramp up. We're also seeing talk about launching antibody testing. And so these are important pieces of data, important pieces of the puzzle. As we get that information, how might that change what we do in the coming month or 2 months?
Let's start with the things that we are confident about having. We're going to have more protective equipment for healthcare workers and for first responders and such. That's going to happen. That's a question of manufacturing, and that will get better over the coming weeks. And as you suggested, we're going to have more testing. The question about tests is, how do we use them appropriately? Right now, we're in a position where we are testing people who are already sick. And that's valuable for those individuals, but not so valuable from a public health standpoint. And I think what's going to be important is to test people who aren't sick, people who are asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic, so we can start to implement strategies that, such as quarantine, and have the surveillance to figure out what's going on out there. Right now, it's kind of a big black box.
I see. You know, I just want to remind folks that Dr. Rubin is the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, the oldest continuously published medical journal in the world, right? More than 200 years now for NEJM. So talking to you is really useful for we here in the lay public, because I imagine that, you know, looking at the world through your eyes and the eyes of the doctors and researchers who are publishing in the New England Journal of Medicine, it's like it feels like what you're seeing is it like 8 or 9 steps ahead of what we're seeing or understand in the general public?
It's an incredibly privileged position. People send their work to us if they think it's interesting, and we almost always think it's interesting, even if we are only end up publishing a small fraction of what we receive. But each day I read through on the order of 150 submissions about COVID-19, and it really keeps me up to date and the other editors as well.
Wait, you read through 150 submissions per day about COVID-19?
Before this outbreak occurred, we got probably an average of 20 to 30 submissions a day. Now we're getting those 20 or 30, and on top of them, another 150. Yes, it's been crazy.
That sounds mind-boggling, to be perfectly honest.
Yes, I used to sleep before this happened.
And what's the range of papers that you're getting?
It's everything. I think we get things that are commentaries that suggest what we should be doing. We get hypotheses that suggest a potential treatment or a potential intervention that might make a difference in the outbreak. We get individual cases that are interesting or case series of people. And then we get the sort of more traditional research, including the ultimate research, so what we call the ultimate, which is the randomized clinical trials.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just looking at the New England Journal's sort of landing page for COVID-19 papers, which, by the way, the New England Journal has opened up and made freely available to the public. We'll have a link to that at onpointradio.org. And you know what catches my eye, Dr. Rubin, is that there are a lot of papers that are looking at or questioning sort of fundamentals on how medicine is done. Right. There's one right here at the top talking about the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on the elderly and whether we ought to be looking at sort of traditional methods of how we deliver healthcare to the elderly as part of the problem here. Do you think that we are on the precipice of this pandemic possibly shining a broader light on just how medicine is practiced, at least here in the United States?
I think almost certainly. I think that we're experimenting with things that we've never done, at least as broadly as this, and some of them are going to stick. For example, now, should you call your doctor with something, you're likely to have a virtual visit with your doctor, a telemedicine appointment. And I think that people are able to, because there's so much of it, people are now going to be able to judge what the quality of those visits should be and whether we should expand that and allow more people access.
I mean, telemedicine is one of those things that has been discussed for years upon years, and all of a sudden it's here. That's what it feels like.
That's right. And it's here because we didn't have an alternative. Whether or not it represents a good alternative is something that maybe we'll have the data to judge when we come out on the other side of this.
Mm. Can you talk to me about a couple of other interesting or surprising pieces of research that have crossed your desk in the 150 papers per day?
Well, one of the interesting observations has been that the number of admissions for routine sorts of medical care has decreased. That's not very surprising. But those include very acute sorts of problems like heart attacks. The number of heart attack admissions has decreased substantially in areas where COVID-19 is present. It certainly could be that people are not getting the care that they need, that they're being untreated for their heart attacks. It's also conceivable there are fewer heart attacks because people have changed their activities and therefore they're just not contracting as many. But it's clearly true that not as many people are coming to the hospital, and it's possible that not as many people have to come to the hospital.
So that seems quite surprising. I feel like every day there's something about how this pandemic is playing out that just is revealing things that we either didn't want to look at or didn't realize about every imaginable system, whether it's our political system, our healthcare system, our system of supply chains. What do you think in terms of medicine? What is the COVID-19 pandemic revealing?
I think one thing that I've seen in medicine, and it's echoed in other sectors too, is the incredible dedication of people. I think that people go into healthcare because they believe in it, and many people now are working incredible hours, putting themselves at risk, in many cases separating themselves from their families because of their concerns about infectiousness, and doing all of this without in under really not so great circumstances, under conditions where some hospitals have been withholding pay because their economics are bad right now because everything is closed down. I'm really impressed with this. Now, don't get me wrong. This is happening in other sectors, too. I'm very thankful for people who are working in grocery stores, for that Amazon delivery guy. I think that there are people putting themselves at risk for the rest of us and that there's a lot of nobility out there.
Well, we are talking this hour with Dr. Eric Rubin. He's the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. He's also a professor of immunology and infectious diseases at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health. Dr. Rubin, hang on. We've got to take another quick break, so we'll be right back with you. But I also just want to let listeners know that coming up on Monday, it's been nearly two decades since Madeleine Albright left her post as U.S. Secretary of State. We will be talking with her on Monday about her new memoir chronicling her life after she left office. So, listeners, what questions do you have for Secretary Albright? I'm particularly interested to hear your questions about the role that diplomacy should be playing right now in managing a global pandemic. So leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That is for Monday's show. We'll be back with Dr. Eric Rubin right after this break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking with Dr. Eric Rubin. He is the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. He's also a professor of immunology and infectious diseases at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And he's giving us his sort of big picture view on where we are with the global pandemic of COVID-19 and where we might go next. So first of all, Dr. Rubin, before we get back to some of the things that might happen in the coming weeks or month, I did want to ask you, actually, about this week. We heard what I consider a glimmer of a little bit of good news, that at least in New York City, they've seen a temporary leveling off of the number of hospital admissions. Is that good news?
Absolutely. I think it is telling us that social distancing works. It had to work, and we're starting to see the fruits of that now.
Okay, so that is good news, even as we're still seeing a terrible amount of deaths. So perhaps it's motivation for communities, for the nation to keep going with social distancing. But let's loop back to some of the things that could happen or could be revealed in the next month and how that might change how we approach this pandemic. Because we've talked about testing of active cases. What about things like antibody testing? Do you have more thoughts on that? How could that change the game?
I think that is a real game changer, although we don't know what it will look like yet. Now, remember, developing an antibody test is both easy and hard. It's relatively simple to measure antibody responses. And not only is it simple, but it's a routine lab test, which can be done in high throughput, so you can get lots and lots of answers in relatively quickly. The problem is interpreting that test and having the information necessary. What's it mean to have a level of X or Y? Does it mean you've been infected? Does it mean that you're protected against subsequent infection? So the hard part is yet to come. Today, we can measure the antibodies. Over the next few weeks, we have to figure out if we can figure out the significance of that. But imagine if you could know whether or not you are protected against disease. That would change things tremendously. It would allow people to go out there and start working again. Having that test could be a game changer.
This week, we talked to a researcher who has been studying coronaviruses for almost four decades. And it was interesting because he told us that there's also the question of how much immunity is conferred after you have these antibodies. That seems to also be a really important question because is it durable immunity? Is it just for a couple of months? Knowing that would really make a difference, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. I don't think we're going to know that in the next few weeks, but we will learn that over time.
Okay. I've come to the point already in our collective efforts against this pandemic where is it grasping for straws to want to hear good news in any quarter? That's why I keep asking these kinds of questions.
No, not at all. I think there is good news here. As you said, the interventions we're using right now are working. We can look across the world and see that things worked in China, things worked in South Korea, things worked in Taiwan and Singapore. So we have tools right now that will help us control the epidemic. There are lots and lots of challenges. I don't want to minimize it at all, but I don't think things are hopeless.
Mm. I wonder if you could take us into your personal experience, personal and professional experience, as this pandemic has rolled on. How has it changed your day-to-day working in the hospital?
So I spend some time in the hospital as an infectious disease doctor. And when I was last in the hospital, which was about a week and a half ago for a couple of days, and I was seeing mostly patients who had other infections, not mostly COVID-19 patients. It's a really kind of surreal experience. The hospital is a place that I've never really seen in this way before. For one thing, there are guards at the entrances checking IDs because very few visitors are allowed now, and so the hallways are pretty empty. For another, they hand you a mask when you walk in, which you wear all day. And so all you see are other masked people all day, mostly staying away from each other. The rooms are, which in parts of the hospital where I work, are double rooms. Most of them have been turned into single rooms to isolate patients from each other. And an entire building, which has been dedicated to cardiology for many years, has been turned over to be virtually all COVID-19. So there is no cardiology ward any longer. There are simply room after room, floor after floor of people who are infected with the virus. It's a very eerie place to be in the hospital right now.
Hmm. Is this, I don't like this phrase, but I'll use it anyway. Is this the new normal?
No. This is the normal for now, though. And after being very optimistic, I have to be clear that we are going to bring this outbreak under control as long as we keep doing what we're doing for now. But we have challenges ahead when we start loosening up on social distancing, and nothing in the hospital is going to change until we can know that this isn't going to continue.
Well, so I wonder what you think about what Dr. Anthony Fauci said on Monday at the White House press briefing that day. He was actually asked if Americans could ever expect to go back to normal. And here's what Dr. Fauci said.
If you want to get to pre-coronavirus, you know, that might not ever happen in the sense of the fact that the threat is there. But I believe with the therapies that will be coming online and with the fact that I feel confident that over a period of time we will get a good vaccine, that we will never have to get back to where we are right back now. So if that means getting back to normal, then we'll get back to normal.
So it's interesting because Dr. Fauci said what our normal will be at the end of this pandemic will also still contain a threat that will always be there. What do you think about that?
I think the threat of epidemics has been hanging over us forever. And those of us who are in infectious disease have been walking around saying the sky could fall, the sky could fall, the sky could fall. And I maybe have lost a little bit of our credibility, but it's always hanging over us. And we know this is the third coronavirus outbreak and they've been coming every 10 years, roughly. That's just, I think, coincidence, but there will be more. But I think there's a lot to learn from this. We can learn how to be prepared, and we can also learn what kinds of specific countermeasures we can be ready to deploy very quickly the next time around. I think we will get back to normal. The other thing that Dr. Fauci mentioned was the tool of new therapies. Those we're going to be learning about over the course of the next few weeks and month or maybe two. We'll learn whether or not we have drugs that are effective for treating disease. That's going to make a big difference to people who are sick, and it might decrease the rate of mortality, and it might mean that fewer people get so sick. But it also could, depending on how it works, decrease the rate of transmission of the virus. It's not as good as a vaccine. We don't want to treat everyone with drugs. There could be issues with that, but it could really make a dent. So I'm hopeful that one of these treatments that are being tested is going to be effective.
As am I. And the thing that then my mind naturally goes to next is, again, this pandemic is like holding up a mirror to our society, because if we get better therapies, fantastic, but will we be able to produce enough of them in time? What will the cost be of those therapies? Will we be able to get them to everyone who needs them, regardless of their insurance coverage? You know, the healthcare system in America is incredibly complex and unwieldy, to say the least. It seems like there are potentially issues down the line, even after the therapies are produced, that could make it harder for people to get what they need when they need it.
You asked about transforming the healthcare system. And I think that one of the most important transformations is this kind of readiness built into the system. How are we going to develop a vaccine that doesn't take a year and a half? Are we going to have the platforms available that are rapid? Are we going to have the regulatory systems in place that are rapid? Are we going to have the research infrastructure to do it? And when we find a drug, a vaccine, are we going to be able to make them rapidly? Remember that we have shortages of standard drugs all the time right now, of things that are critically important to people. And there's no surprise that there's a demand for them. Here we have an unexpected demand. And I think perhaps in the best of all possible worlds, we can take some of these lessons not just to prepare for the next epidemic, but to produce a more nimble and equitable system.
That would be a wonderful outcome to what is a tragedy unfolding worldwide right now. My last question for you, Dr. Rubin, I'm going to go back a little bit. And say, you said earlier that perhaps infectious diseases specialists had lost a little bit of their credibility because they were saying the sky is going to fall, the sky is going to fall. Well, if that is indeed the case, I don't think you had lost any of your credibility, but definitely people are paying attention now. And what I wonder is, there's no doubt that we will see, no doubt that we'll see new emerging infectious diseases, perhaps even more frequently than we did before, hopefully not on the scale of COVID-19. But ideally, what are the lessons that we ought to be learning now regarding future epidemics that you would like us to see apply when the next one happens?
I think they'd fall into a few categories. Number one, technological. How are we going to have things that can be rapidly deployed, rapidly developed and deployed? And that is a question, both a scientific question and a sort of technical engineering question that we need to deal with. The second is sort of a leadership question, which is, how do we make sure that we have a system that can approve drugs and vaccines, that can help distribute them, et cetera. And then the final is the healthcare system fixes. How can we do this in a way that's fair, fair across different groups, and deliver the care that people really need? One important lesson of any epidemic is epidemics aren't confined to one group. They spread outside of those groups very rapidly. And so we all benefit when everyone benefits.
Well, Dr. Eric Rubin is the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. He's also a professor of immunology and infectious diseases at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health. Dr. Rubin, thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Thank you for having me.
The New England Journal of Medicine has made its coverage of COVID-19 open to the public. We've got a link to it at onpointradio.org. Now, billions of people are trying to cope with the challenges of isolation brought about by COVID-19 lockdowns. It's a new experience for almost everyone, except maybe for a few folks who dedicated their lives to professions where confinement comes with the territory.
So my name is Ryan Ramsey, and I used to be a submarine captain. So I've been in shutdown for the last 5 weeks in the UK. I'm allowed out once a day to go and do exercise. I'm allowed to go and get shopping. And then the rest of the time is spent in the house and in the garden when you can get out there.
You heard that right. He's a submarine captain. Ryan Ramsey commanded the British nuclear-powered HMS Turbulent from 2008 to 2011. And he talked with us about what being a submariner taught him about coping with isolation.
Submarines are really amazing. I mean, they're the most complex machine that the military owns. And you take them to operate in somewhere that's less explored than space. And you do it all with one team of 130 people. And in my last year of commanding, I went away for 286 days on a deployment, of which during that period of time, 237 of them were underwater in sometimes patrols up to 90 days at a time. Days roll into weeks, roll into months. So isolation for that period of time is really quite difficult. So the things that become really, really important are to make sure that you know you have some rules and you stick by them. So first one's about routine. So it's about having your own personal routine and sticking to it. That makes the days go faster. It makes the weeks go faster. It makes the months go faster. The second one is about cleanliness. It's about cleaning, making sure that you clean the environment that's around you. Now, sailors, we're all used to this because we have to. A clean submarine is a happy submarine and it's an efficient submarine. But in our own homes, we need to do exactly that. Make sure we've got a clean environment to work in and to live in, because that's all we've got for the next few months. The third one is about downtime. So when you use downtime effectively, I always think that you need to do something totally different. But it's about learning something new. It's about reading different things. It's about avoiding hearing about COVID-19. It's such a fluid situation. It's such a wicked problem that everybody is trying to tame. What you don't want to do is create huge amounts of negativity within yourself and within the household that you're living. Look for some positive stuff and stick on that. My big piece of advice is stay at home. The whole piece of this is giving the National Health Services or the health services around the world time to contain this problem. I felt really helpless, to be quite frank. Normally, I'd be front and center when I was in the military, going out and helping and doing whatever else. And I can't do anything else except stay at home and do what I've been told to do to give them the time to bring it on through. You got to make the best out of it. You can, and keep motivated and keep as happy as you can be, and infuse other people to be happy and focused and give them all of that. And then that way we make it through together.
Captain Ryan Ramsey commanded the British nuclear-powered submarine HMS Turbulent from 2008 to 2011. Captain Ramsey spoke with us from lockdown in the UK, where he said he's jogging once a day and rediscovering his love of playing the guitar. For all of On Point's coverage of COVID-19, go to our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.